This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and Fraser Nelson. So today, as we head into Easter weekend, Matt Hancock headed up the Downing Street press conference. Katie, one of the things that he announced was a PPE plan. Can you tell us what he wants to do?
Yes, so this is a free strand plan, and it comes after the government has received a lot of criticism over the level of protective equipment there is. There's been lots of talk there's a shortage. If you listen to first-hand accounts from NHS staff, they say there is a shortage. But the government and the line from number 10 over the past couple of weeks has been that there's lots to get out there. They have plenty and they're trying to. In Matt Hancock's comments today, he did seem to accept that there was an issue, even though he tried to phrase it in a way which was more an action plan than stating there was a clear problem. But ultimately on guidance, I think one of the key things is it was about who needs PPE, when they need it, and who doesn't need it. And the key thing here was that you should only use it if you have to. So I think part of this is making sure people aren't using PPE who don't need it. So they said, well, there's a clinical need, and the new guidance is the idea that items of PPE can be used for a whole session. They don't have to be changed after treating each individual patient. And if outside of health and social care, the suggestion is that you don't need PPE. So you should just, if you don't work in health and social care, if you are someone perhaps such as ourselves, we should simply wash our hands and keep 2 meters apart. And this idea of face masks, which we're hearing other countries go for, is not something the UK is currently recommending.
And Fraser, one of the other questions that Matt Hancock had posed to him was the continuing human and economic cost of a sustained lockdown. And this is also a topic that you look at in your latest Telegraph column, where you quote government attempts at estimating what are called avoidable deaths, people who otherwise wouldn't have died had it not been for coronavirus, as 150,000. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. They're trying to calculate now how many people are going to be affected, indeed how many lives are going to be lost by the downgrading of the NHS, which is now underway. We found out recently, for example, that a third fewer people are going to accident and emergency last month than would normally go. Now, that's not to say there were a third fewer accidents or emergencies. We see this, by the way, in every country which is going through sort of COVID-related preparations for the health service. In New York, there are hospitals reporting that the number of heart attack patients being treated is going down a lot. The implication being that there are people who are not seeking medical care who would need it. Now, Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, is particularly interested in this. He's always said that COVID kills people in two ways, directly and then indirectly, because the response to COVID will distort the health service. And so government members are trying to put together a way of understanding it. Now, one of the figures being used in the various papers to assess that is 150,000 avoidable deaths. Now, that is a lot. That's assuming, by the way, that there's no mitigation, that this thing continues for a while, that the rest of the NHS continues to contract its care of non-COVID patients in this way. And that's the figure which, oddly, Matt Hancock seemed to deny in the press conference. But I'm not quite sure how much long that denial will last, because there were quite a few people who saw that figure.
Katie, I mean, what do we know about the peak? Is it still coming this Sunday, or could we be pushing it further down the line?
So the suggestion is that reports that the peak was going to be Easter Sunday may now be premature. The peak could be later down the line. That's the latest chatter. I think it's worth pointing out, though, that today we've had the highest number of fatalities yet, a record daily rise of 980, and that's hospital specific. So if that's not near the peak, I think it's looking increasingly bad for the UK, clearly, but also just in terms of the UK compared to other countries, because I think even on, Italy and Spain's worst days, they haven't reached, above 1,000. So I think if it isn't anytime, you know, in the next couple of days. And actually, this is going to be for several weeks more, this build up. I think that is going to be really quite worrying. And it wasn't quite clear from the comments today. I mean, when people are talking about ending the lockdown, there is a sense you have to get to the peak first. But in all the comments so far that we've had this week from the medical officers, deputies, you know, Chris Whitty as well, Patrick Vallance, the chief scientific officer, there's the sense that even after you have the highest admission to ICU, which we don't have a sense that we have yet, there's been no implication that we have yet had the highest admission to the ICU, then you would expect 2 weeks of high fatalities to follow that. So even in government, I think that when you speak to people about when they might even think about the lockdown, it definitely wouldn't be easing for at least another 3 weeks, because they expect the numbers to be very bad for another 3 weeks. So I think that gives you some sense that it's not as though on Sunday there'll be a very high number and then it will definitely start to go down. I think the government is braced for very bad news for several weeks to come.
So, Fraser, one of the questions posed to Matt Hancock today was, why doesn't he just level with people and say, look, we'll be in this situation until at least probably the end of April?
Well, I think the government knows the situation's changing almost every day. There is a lack of clarity in this. And if there's a lack of clarity, that means it could be over a lot quicker than we think or a lot later than we think. And right now, Matt Hancock's job is to try to work out, can the NHS cope? Are hospitals going to be overwhelmed? Are there going to be enough intensive care units for COVID treatments? And although the government haven't released the figures, I also understand that about a third of the intensive care units are being used by COVID patients, and about a third by non-COVID patients, and the other third of them are not being used at all. Now, those figures, if the government were to release them, it would suggest that the health system is actually able to cope, and that the lockdown did succeed in buying time for the NHS to scale up. It suggests that the NHS is, even with the deaths being at the heartbreakingly high figures that we see today, almost 1,000 deaths a day in Britain, this does not equate to hospitals being overrun. So the NHS scaling up operation has been a success, and that the intensive care unit has got more leeway than the government is currently at a state where it's willing to admit.
And Fraser, this is part of the question that you pose in your column as well, which is whether or not the cure could actually be worse than the poison itself.
Well, that's in terms of the social harm that the lockdown is doing. And it's not just lives lost. For example, the government had thought that 20% of pupils would still be in schools, the children of key workers, the vulnerable children, of whom there are a great many, for whom school is a lifeline quite often out of very difficult domestic situations. They've been quite shocked to find out that the figure is not 20%, the figure is 2%. You're talking about educational damage there, children deprived of their right to be educated in school. Now, why would you continue this if it's not necessary? The Swedes don't think it's necessary, they're continuing schools. The Danes are bringing schools back after the Easter holidays. And so when you're looking at the effect of a lockdown, you've got to look right across the board. You have to look at domestic violence, for example. There are reports in France that that's gone up quite a lot. I mean, women who are victims of domestic violence have got no escape during a lockdown. It's a very serious situation. Isabel Harman's looking at this in an article she's going to be writing for the magazine next week. And you've got vaccinations. One of the things Chris Whitty is interested in is how many children are not being brought forward for vaccination because people don't want to bother the NHS or even their GP at the moment. So when you add all of that up, it's quite difficult to put a figure on it. That's why they were trying to do this modelling with 150,000 figures. I mean, where do you go? The funny thing about modelling is that you can get almost any figure you want depending on the input. So it's difficult to be precise about it because the situation is still so uncertain. But the question government members will have to ask is the lockdown causing more harm than the COVID itself? And once COVID gets under control, and we could be at that stage within the next few weeks, then it's pretty hard to keep justifying the lockdown.
Katie, what about pressure from the continent? We know that in the coming weeks, Denmark, Germany, Austria and the Czech Republic, as just a few of examples, are starting to lift their lockdown slowly and carefully. Do you think the government is going to be facing more pressure to lift our lockdown, given that people on the continent seem to be doing that?
Well, look, right now, public opinion and public support of lockdown in the UK is very high. I think There are figures in number 10 across government who have been surprised by the amount of public support there is for lockdown, perhaps even slightly unnerved that people have so quickly taken to this social distancing. So I think that some people, and Fraser pointed out this out in his column, there are figures in cabinet who think that you can't change social distancing until public opinion changes anyway. But I would say of that group, many think public opinion is fickle. It can change very quickly. And that's why you need to have a plan ready to go. So I do think once other countries in Europe start easing, and if that works out, if there isn't a quick rise in infections, people might start to change their opinions on how the lockdown needs to continue. But this is a question which is now being asked behind the scenes and attempting to be being answered. So you have the Department of Health working with the Treasury now to start in the next few days to have some form of modelling over what potential routes out of the lockdown phasing could look like. It's very early stages, but it is a conversation that is beginning to happen. I think ministers from Bays are being brought in on that. I think whatever they do go for, it is going to be phased. It's not going to happen all at once. There have been some interesting reports this week. One was the idea that 20 to 30 year olds, or I think 18 to 30 year olds, might get to go out first because they are the least affected in terms of the illness. I think that if you speak to figures in government, I think there is a slight level of skepticism about how viable that would be. Firstly, if you only get a specific age group out, that is going to potentially require quite heavy policing to make sure it actually works, because not that I would obviously commit a crime, but as a 31-year-old, you know, there's a grey area where lots of people might just try and, you know, move around it. So I think all of these suggestions are actually quite complicated while you try and put them in action. But if you look at schooling, I think that is something where it hasn't, you know, there are fewer children going to school than currently imagined. And if you think about productivity and how you get the economy going, I think one thing that is hampering productivity is the fact that you have lots of parents who are living at home, expected to work from home, but also having to look after their children all day and potentially try and give them some homeschooling in the meantime. So I think were something like that to happen, you could see how it could tick quite a few boxes on the road back.
And Fraser, finally, on Katie's point about the government not quite expecting such civil obedience, which you also mentioned in your column, of course, we heard this week that that Reuters had a report saying that the government didn't even consider lockdown as part of its modelling. I've written as well about the Chinese measures and how back in January we were thinking that this would never work here. But it does seem that the public is much more amenable to a lockdown than a lot of politicians and journalists expected. So why do you think that is?
Well, this is what is so extraordinary about this. So they have year after year of pandemic planning where they model every scenario they can think of. The tool of lockdown was never in the pandemic response toolkit because people thought that the democracies just simply don't respond that way. I remember, Cindy, when the Wuhan lockdown happened, we were sitting in editorial conference back in the days where we sat in editorial conference, talking to you about how obedient the Chinese are and they're going along with this this lockdown. Isn't there something in Chinese culture that makes them amenable to this, where in British culture nobody would do it? And that is what the British modellers thought as well. And hence, that's why they thought 20% of people in schools. So that's why they thought there would be 3 million people taking up the job protection scheme rather than 9 million. Of course, because this is unprecedented, you never know quite what to expect. There's too many variables. You can't really model it. But suffice to say that the concern that Boris Johnson was having before he took a turn for the worst this time last week was that lockdown was going too far, that he really forced through the advice because he didn't really expect people to follow it. But they've taken to it, and his biggest concern was work. The government's message is supposed to be stay at work. If you can work from home, great. If you can't, keep going to work. But that message ended up being extinguished by Isaac Levido's former Tory campaign chief. He came along with his other phrase, stay at home, protect the NHS, save lives. That was Matt Hancock's message today. It's quite a strong one, it's a simple one, and it's one that people have responded to way more sort of immediately and faithfully than the government had expected. So I think, as Douglas Murray says in his article this week, there is this idea of Britain being a sort of selfish country of people who wouldn't really behave collectively to save elderly people from a pandemic has been disproved by the extraordinary things we've seen in the last few weeks. We've had plenty of tragedy, no end of tragedy. The COVID deaths themselves are a daily tragedy. But we've also seen incredible things, the construction of the NHS Nightingale in 9 days, the way that communities have actually come together to help each other, the way that everybody is staying home because if they think this will is what is necessary to protect the NHS, this is what people will do, millions of people, pretty much the whole country. What's remarkable, I think, isn't those violating the lockdown, it's the tens of millions of people who are obeying it. And I think that when this is over, we look back on this as thinking one of the reasons why we thought the social fabric of Britain, when tested, proved far stronger than a lot of people had expected.
Fraser and Katie, thanks very much. And you can hear Douglas Murray read out his column in our new podcast, Audio Reads, which is released every Saturday morning on Spectator Radio and features three columnists from that week's issue reading out their articles. To find that, just search for Spectator Radio. And you can also find the latest episode of Women with Balls on Spectator Radio, where Katie talks to Labour MP Jess Phillips, former SPAD Olivia Roby, and Lloyds Banking Group's Fiona Cannon about financial control and how it's an invisible form of domestic abuse, but it is also on the rise during this coronavirus lockdown. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.